Hello, this is Dan Lebatard, and for those of you unfamiliar with the story we're about to tell this week, Jason Williams was an all-star in the NBA. He was charismatic. He was a legitimate New York sports star who was hired after his playing career because he was so good at the doing of television by NBC to try and recreate some of the stuff that Charles Barkley has done, and he would have been very good at doing it. And then his life fell apart because he accidentally took the life of someone else. It was a famous night that was at his mansion where he accidentally shot his limo driver while playing with guns and drinking. And then the resultant cover-up, which had a lot of details in it that are hard to listen to because he just, in an act of what he describes now as cowardice, he just was shocked and panicked and saw his life flash before his eyes, and so he tried to cover it up. Jason Williams is not someone that I've heard a lot from since all of this happened to him. He went to prison for 27 months for everything that happened in this story. I've never heard him talk as honestly and as emotionally about this as he does in this interview. He is clearly a broken man trying to do some good work with what is left of what used to be his life, helping people with addiction, helping people with alcoholism. So I think that this is the best South Beach session that we have done in terms of richness of emotion and detail, and I'm looking forward to getting to it here. But first, here's Mike Ryan telling you a little bit about who sponsors South Beach Sessions and everything on the Lebatard and Friends Network, helping us keep all this content free for you.
Dan, it's brought to you by ZipRecruiter. It's a new year, the perfect opportunity to take your business to the next level by hiring the right people. But finding qualified candidates can be challenging. ZipRecruiter.com/beach makes it easy. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, South Beach Session listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH, ZipRecruiter.com/beach.
I don't think you're going to be able to stop listening to this one. This is former NBA All-Star Jason Williams, as raw and as candid as he can be about very difficult subject matter. So I've been wanting to talk to this guy for a long time. I've been an admirer for a long time of how much personality he had and how he turned his charisma into something, and then his life, fell in a ditch, and he seemed interesting and it seemed like he fell off the map. And now the work that he is doing helps explain perhaps the roots of some of what happened with him. Jason Williams is someone who had a very good career over across how many years, Jason?
Probably around 10.
So a very good career across 10 years, and you were something of a media sensation in New York, correct?
Correct.
And what was happening there? You grasped on to the idea of, I'm going to show a little bit of personality and people are going to like me for my mouth. I'm going to be able to sell that.
Yeah, well, like you have the relationship with your dad, I have the same relationship with my dad. If he was here right now, he would be sitting right on side of me, and he was a great storyteller. And I took that on with me because he was always with me, and I used to tell stories. And also I played for Lou Carnesecca at St. John's University, who is charismatic and had a personality. And I've been always very transparent with my life. So I guess that's what put me, if you want to say, at the upper echelon of athletes.
New York made you a star. New York with a mouth, with a little bit of game, right, made you a legitimate sports star. And with that life came all sorts of things, right? All of a sudden, I mean, temptation was all around you long before that. That's just playing in the NBA. But playing in New York and now getting some fame beyond basketball, that ends up resulting in what?
Yeah, and I've been through a whole lot, Dan. I'm not here to cry my bill or ask anybody to feel sorry for me. All the stuff that's happened to me, I, of course, I was the one who was reckless. I take full responsibility. I'm sorry for it. And there's not a minute, well, let's be honest, not an hour that goes by that I don't think about Mr. Gustafi and all the pain that I've caused his sister. He didn't have any children, or he wasn't married, but all the pain that I caused his sister and the pain that I've caused my family and my friends also. I had a night where I was just out with my family. It wasn't like it was reported in the media. Hold on a second, if I may.
Forgive me for the interruption. For the audience that doesn't know, because I don't assume that the people listening to this know what exactly happened with your life. So for the audience that doesn't know, and I don't know all of the details here, but I've been fascinated by the story, a former Globetrotter had brought a driver that you just mentioned his name right now to your home, your mansion, for a party that night. And he ended up dead, and then you got into a lot of trouble for appearing to cover that up.
Yeah, we were having dinner. You know, I lost three sisters, two to AIDS and a stabbing. And my third sister was shot in the face by her husband. And my first sister was stabbed 17 times, beat over the face with a hammer, one of the first women to ever catch the AIDS virus. She shared needles with my second sister because she was robbed for $2. And so I lost three sisters, and I had to adopt both their kids and while I was at St. John's University. So to fast forward up, after I got hurt, I went to bring my grandchildren to a Harlem Globetrotter game, and I saw a couple of players that played on the Harlem Globetrotters who played with me, and I offered them to come back to my house. We stopped off at a restaurant. The owner of the restaurant called the limousine driver, whose name is Mr. Gustafi, who I met that night. He dined with us, had jokes with us, and had a good time. We went back to my house, and I was showing around the home. I went into my bedroom, and I have escape machines at my home, and I was showing shotguns that I paid a lot of money for. And showing them all the different kind of designs and what they do, a 410, a 12-gauge, blahzy, blahzy. And a gun went off. When I went to hand one over to somebody, and it flicked closed, and it went off, and it hit Mr. Gustafi, the limousine driver, and killed him instantly. I did not know he was in the house, did not see him, did not see him behind me. And worst day of everybody's life who's involved in that. And I'm sorry, and I don't know where else to go but to tell you that, you know, every day I wake up, I wish it would have never happened. I shouldn't have been acting recklessly. First of all, I shouldn't have had guns in my house. I don't even know why, even though they were shotguns. You know, I watch all the stuff. I listen to your show. I listen to ESPN, and I watch how athletes have guns. I'm not comparing. I'm just identifying for myself, Dan.
You had guns without even knowing why you had guns?
Yeah. You know, well, you know, I had handguns, too. It wasn't just shotguns.
But it's just part of what that life was.
Yeah, but that's BS because, you know, I've never been to a club where I really start trouble. And, you know, what happens is when you lose your core people, when you lose your team, your team to help you get there, and that's and they're not digging into you, they're really helping you. And they say, Jay, it's time to go home. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. And you go, oh, you go home. I'll find some new friends who are not going to tell me to go home. And then you find that new posse, then they find a posse, and then you're surrounded with a bunch of people that you don't know. We call chicken heads. And why would I have a gun? You know, nobody's going to rob me. No, I'm not in places where I'm going to get robbed. Why athletes have guns is for the inner circle, the people that know that they're sick of their secrets. And you keep that for the people that are around you all the time to let them know, hey, I'm no chump. You better not say I was doing drugs. You better not say I was doing this or that. That's where that comes from. You know, how many times you see somebody have to shoot their way out of a club? That doesn't happen. So it's just my low self-esteem and my recklessness that I've caused the drama and the pain that went down, Dan. There's no excuse for that. I'm not, you know, I would never own a gun, not even at the state or the federal law prohibits me from owning a gun because I'm a convicted felon. I just don't even want to see one no more.
I mean, it's ruined your life, right? Like you were on top of the world in the way that you're talking about
that. Yeah, but then it didn't ruin my life. It ruined the life of Mr. Christofi's. You know, he was trying to get his life together. He just came out of a sentence, and he was didn't have family, but he had his sister, and he had his whole life to live for. And I don't know if you know how it would ever feel to take something from somebody that's all they're going to have in their life, you know. And I did that, and it could have been prevented because I was reckless. You know, I shouldn't. It could have been avoid it. So, you know, that's where I'm at with that. And I have to do what I do every day to try to pass time because it's difficult when you accidentally take an innocent man's life. So it's painstaking.
Why are you talking about this?
Well, I came here today to talk to you. First of all, I love the relationship that you have with your dad. My dad never been to the hospital in 75 years. And when I was on every channel, you know, he had a stroke and he couldn't recover from it. And he's my best friend. And he died. So two people died that night, actually. You know, so I see you on TV and I see you with your dad. And I was like, you know what? I want to do this show. I want to talk to Dan and one of these days. And came in and you said you were interested in talking to
me. But your story, your story is crazy, Jason. Your story is, I don't know if the audience understands what you've been through and whatever the daily depression is that you must live with because of the guilt that you feel, because you're articulating it very well, the guilt that you feel because you took another man's life and yet you too have had your life ruined by this reckless accident that involved that night there was too much drinking, right?
There was drinking going on that night, and in my court case, there was not alcohol in it, but it was recklessness enough. If you have being reckless, period, let alone having a drink, one drink is too many to be handling a gun at all. You know, I know this now. I knew that then. I was just reckless, and when, you know, you're reckless, these kind of things happen. Why I'm here to talk to you is because for the last 4.5 years, you know, I've been helping people to have drug and alcohol conditions, and a lot of people here in Florida. Substance abuse, anxiety and depression, just like myself, started a program and teamed up with a program that's been around for 8 years, Futures Recovery Healthcare, and we brought something to it. I've been doing this now for four years as I've been sober, and we teach through outdoor adventure therapy. So we're jumping out of airplanes, we're scuba diving, we're snorkeling, along with our therapists and psychiatrists.
Well, I want to talk to you about all this, and I'm going to give you the opportunity to talk about this because it sounds like what your life's work has become. I see that you've walked in here with four people that you described as your crew, these are your sponsors, I don't know the word that you use.
No, these are my teammates. These are people that are in rebound who help me, help others, help myself.
Well, that's what you've dedicated yourself to now, right? Because you carry around the shame and the guilt and all of the, I can't even imagine, Jason, what you've been through. And I understand that you're not the victim here. I understand that there were actual victims here and you feel great remorse about that. But this had to have broken you in many ways, living with this.
Yeah. You know, I still have children who are not happy with the situation, of course. They're not happy when I do interviews like this because I'm bringing back up something and they might meet new friends and they go, oh, man, I didn't know. Just thought your dad was an NBA All-Star. I didn't know this. And, you know, believe it or not, you know, you try to disappear. And I bought a cabin in the middle of the woods and tried to drink myself damn near to death in a one for Charles Oakley and Curtis Martin coming up and doing an intervention. You know, I wouldn't have come down to, you know, to Futures Recovery Healthcare and get better and stay here. And that's
you were going to drink yourself to death.
I was drinking myself to death. I was 80 pounds heavier than I am right now. You know, I was falling downstairs. I just gave up on myself. And thank God I had people that didn't give up on me.
What was that intervention like? What do you remember?
I remember Curtis Martin teaching Bible study at my house now for 20 years, every Wednesday. He might have missed one. And I remember him not pressing me to go, but suggesting it. And I remember me going up and buying a cabin in the middle of the woods and Charles Oakley and Curtis Martin coming up there and doing an intervention. And Curtis came up with "What Will Jesus Do" mantra. And Charles Oakley came up with a baseball bat and "What Would This Louisville Slugger Do?" And one way or the other, they got me into the car and they brought me down and I found out what I'm really good at. I noticed that you were saying, oh, he was pretty good basketball player. And I might have been a pretty good basketball player or a good basketball player or all-star, but then I am being gifted from God to help people beat their substance abuse and alcohol problems. And I'm say this with a humble heart that I'm very good at that through the grace of God.
Because you tell your story very vulnerably, very honestly. Well, Charles Oakley was with a baseball bat and you're drunk. And you answer the door, and we're going to either do this Curtis Martin's way, which is the Lord's way, or Charles Oakley is going to beat you until we leave.
Exactly right. And that's what I needed to do an intervention. There's no, you know, messing that up. And Oakley to this day comes down to, you know, rebounding futures every, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, and he just pop up.
How did he have this reputation that everyone knew that if Charles Oakley shows up with a bat, everyone's got to go running? Like, how does everyone know that?
Let me tell you something. If Charles Oakley didn't need a baseball bat, first of all, I could barely stand. I was 80 pounds heavier. And Charles Oakley.
But he brought one just in case.
Just in case, you know. And you know what? And it was crazy because Curtis kept looking over my shoulder. And I was like, what? So he's looking in my face. And I'm like, what is he looking? I look back and Charles will put something behind his back. I was like, that's odd. What is he doing? And then when I look back, you know, he was pissed because he thought I was going to come to this beautiful cabin, which it was beautiful, but with snow and white snow everywhere. And he came up in his purple, like, Range Rover with white interior. There was nothing but mud up there. So he was already pissed that his all his truck was on. Now he got to, you know, try to get Jason into a car who's drunk and might throw up all over the place. So he wasn't happy.
And so they just threw you in rehab right from there. They went straight to the facility.
Chris Mullen, you know, the best ball shooter in the world.
Also struggled with all of this.
Yeah. And he was like a sponsor to me. And he's the one who said, look, you know, I got a coach, but you guys got to, you know, you got to go get Jason. He's in a bad way. And Coach Conoseca made the final call, and he sent up Charles Oakley, and he needed all of Charles Oakley and Curtis Martin to get me into rehab. And I thank God every day that he did.
Was that the first time that you had considered the idea that you would have a problem? Had you gone in and out of rehab before that, or was that?
No, I just know that I had never been in a rehab, didn't really know about it. You know, believe it or not, a lot of athletes and a lot of people that are brown and black like ourselves don't know about treatment centers. They don't know that you can go away and get better. You know, rehab was something, and then the stigma that goes along with it, right? We're athletes. We're warriors. We're not supposed to be weak. We're supposed to take care of everything on ourselves. So I never considered it. I knew I had a problem even at a younger age, you know, raising two children through St. John's. You know, I had a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, my sister's kids. I know I would drink, and I knew that went on for a long time. But, you know, I when my dad was alive, he would go everywhere with me. You know, and I tell you, you know, stories, we can go on and on, but, you know, about stories about my dad. And he used to put a cot in front of, you go to Salvation Army, put a cot in front of my penthouse doors and sleep on it. And why? Because we would know that he snored, and me and my brother used to take a magic marker that glows in the dark and step on, put them down so we know which one's the tiles not to step on so we can get out. And then he once went to the bathroom, we heard, he was like, oh man, what's that? Uh-oh. You know, he was putting the light on and off, and he saw that, so he went and bought a cot from Salvation Army, and he slept on there for the good part of my career, and that's when I became a good basketball player in the NBA.
Explain that to me again. I'm not totally understanding how it is your father was raising you this way with
I was an NBA all-star. I was a star in the NBA, and my dad knew that I was allergic to alcohol, so he would follow me everywhere, just like your dad is with you all the time.
To make sure that you wouldn't do this?
To make sure that I would be on the straight and narrow. We had...
Because he was trying to protect you from what he thought was hereditary family illness.
I would tell – exactly right. And I'll tell you this, that one day after the game, Bruce Willis came up to him, and my dad had a construction company. And, you know, I had my CDL driver's license. I laid brick. I did all that with him. And then went to the game and played Michael Jordan. Did you know that? I would feed up all our animals, and then I would go lay brick or drive a tractor trailer with a D6 or D8 Caterpillar bulldozer on it. And then go to shoot around and then come back and lay brick and then go to play a basketball game. That's just what my dad wanted me on side of him all the time. He used to dribble with two hands and go, man, basketball ain't no, that ain't no job. That ain't no real job. And that's what he had to do. And I remember after a game one time, Bruce Willis was waiting for me, and he was like, you know, go with me. We go out and, you know, have a couple of drinks. And I said, Dad, this is Bruce Willis. And, you know, he's like, who? You know, and I said, Bruce Willis, can I go out with him? He said, where's Bruce Willis from? I said, he's from, you know, Die Hard. And he's like, oh, man. He was like, that's my man. I got to come see you tomorrow anyway. I bought these four batteries, and I can't put this water. I'm like, man, you know? That Bruce Willis from Die Hard Batteries from the movie. And he was like, oh, okay, appreciate it then. You know, and I went home that night, and that's just the way he was.
So wait a minute. Your father was basically fathering you as you're an NBA All-Star?
Yeah.
You're still a kid in almost every way where he's trying to still protect you from all the bad stuff.
100% did not. He used to tell me all the time, he said, Jason, you got to play at 120% if Shaq playing at 40% because you damn sure ain't that good. You ain't that good. And he said, potential mean you haven't done shit lately. And he said, and man, he said, you living in the fast lane. If I missed a free throw, which I was a terrible free throw shooter, I missed anything, he'd be like, oh, we ain't doing nothing tonight. We going straight to the house. You know, he was just that kind of guy. And he didn't believe that basketball was a job. So every morning I fed up all our rescue animals, and then I went to work at construction, then I went to shoot around. That's how my whole life went.
I mean, okay, so your whole life is crazy because we sort of just bypassed that you've lost your sisters in pretty horrible ways, and we've sort of bypassed that you raised from a very early age her kids. But what happened along the path where you lost your dad, and did you lose your way immediately? Or
immediately. Once my dad came to the house after the accident, he said, Jay, I feel like I couldn't get out of bed. You was on every channel, and I couldn't move. And selfishly, I didn't think nothing of it because my dad has never missed a day of his work or never been, and it was all these press outside the house and all, you know, just helicopters and everything. And I was just selfishly, I just thought about myself. I didn't even think about his health. And then my dad had a stroke, and then we got him back to about 80%. And I remember telling him, I said, Dad, you got to get back to work. And I said, you know, we ain't have insurance. I had to pay $1.3 million. And he said, $1.3 million for what? For me? He said, you should have let me die. And I was like, no, we're going to get back. And we tried to get him back. And then we had the case coming on, and he caught his second stroke, and his mind was fine, Dan. He was just a big, strong man caught in his body. So, my dad lived 2 years paralyzed like that, and I moved him every 20 minutes. So I hired people. He didn't die from one bed sore on him. He died because he just couldn't eat, and he just died of sticking bones, man. And that all came from the stress that I put upon my dad.
Wow. Okay, so, Jason, you blame yourself for...
No, it's what it is. That's what happened. I it ain't just one person. One person is enough, but... You know, I don't like doing these shows anymore. I just love getting, I'm blessed with, Jason means healer. You know, I'm just blessed with the ability to help people get better. But, you know, I always watch you on the TV. I was like, you know what? One day I'm going to re-meet you. I met you in the locker rooms. I met you before. You've been covering sports as long as I've been playing them. I always saw you with you and your dad. I always had empathy for you but also not only empathy, but almost like, wow, man, my dad would be doing the same thing.
Well, I recognize what you are saying. Like when I say, well, it sounds like you were just a kid and your dad was still dragging you around the NBA. I didn't grow up for a long time in that respect, even though I was responsible in other places like you were raising your sister's kids. You were clearly an adult right there when that was forced on you. And I just remember when everything that happened with you, I remember thinking to myself, I could see myself in a moment of weakness, about to lose everything, about to lose the things my father has protected me, or in his case, brought, you know, come to freedom from Cuba to make sure to give me. I saw myself like, what would I do in that situation? If I accidentally killed somebody, I was going to lose everything that I'd ever identified as my self-worth. Would I do the right thing, or would I cover it up? Would I try to cover? And when I read the details of your story, I felt for you because in that moment, I'm sure you've replayed it a million different times. In that moment, you've said that you saw cowardice.
Cowardice, 100%. Because the gun went off. Nobody expected the gun to go off. And we called 911 inside of 8 seconds. And I just ran. And I ran and jumped in a swimming pool. And I was butt naked. I didn't even know how I got there. To this day, I don't know how. But I know what I did wasn't the way my dad raised me. That was a cowardly act, and I'm not going to blame it on shock or anything else. I just did it, and that eats me up along with, you know, just if I had to redo everything again, I know it could be avoided, Dan. That's what I'm saying. I know it could have been avoided.
But if you could do everything again, what, I mean, are you, you?
I won't ever own a gun. I could tell you that.
But Jason, you must do this every day. You must do something because you carry the weight of this and because you tell your story and because it reaches people, because it's vulnerable and anybody can understand this, like you're carrying this on you every damn day in a way that's got to hurt and be dispiriting. And you are trying to do this good work now to heal some of these places, correct? That's what you're trying to do.
That's what I do, you know, being a Futures Recovery Healthcare every day, Dan. And I don't do it for just helping people, but it helps me. You know, I get a chance to, you know, watch the light go on in other people's lives. I get to stay with them for 30 or 90 days or, and then they become part of my family because some part of my family still upset with me. And here, you know, some of you, you know, we say at Rebound here, we say that blood makes you related, but accountability and love and empathy makes us family now. So I get a chance to help people who are not judging me. Some people say I live in a bubble, but I actually love helping people get better. Why they help me? So I get a chance to jump on airplanes and snorkel and scuba with them, with our psychiatrists and my therapists. And when I leave you right now, I'm going back. We'll go to a group. We'll process this. They will process this, who are watching this, with our psychiatrists. And I need it. Right? This is a therapy session for me. And for everyone here that comes with me, I can't have somebody come spend 30 days with me and then say, I'm going to go do the best show on ESPN. And you guys stay here, you know, and they were like, Jay, we go where you go. You know, we're not, you know, and my whole goal now is not only to help people beat addiction, but it is to lift the stigma. If you have cancer, you get chemo. And
but your dad knew you had it, right? Like he knew he wanted to keep you out of that.
Yeah.
Were you not drinking at all?
Well, you know what? No, around my dad, no. Not a bit.
Privately, you were drinking, but he was trying.
If my dad was not around, and it was the off season, yes. Because, you know, why I had to play hard is because my dad was like, you know, you got freedom the harder and the better you played and the team had to win. If the team was winning and the coach was happy, you know, even at St. John's, you know, when I played for Lou Carnesecca, if I was doing something wrong and Lou Carnesecca couldn't get to me, he'll say, all right, I know what I'm going to do. And he'll show up in the projects to my dad's house. And then, you know, I'll be so mad at Lou, but it made me who I am today because, you know, it wasn't like parents today where you get a timeout or, you know, here, you know, my dad was a serious man. He was serious about, you know, this disease. I have a disease, Dan, that tells me I don't have a disease. I have a disease, the only disease you can go to jail for. You know I had an accident, but the way I acted after the accident still eats me up also.
Well, take me back to that because you said, I don't think, and I know some of these details, but I don't know how much of the audience knows these details. You mentioned butt naked in the pool. Take me back to the moment you call 911. Then what do you remember?
Because
you said you didn't want it to be shock, but it sounds like you behaved in a way that feels out of character to you.
All I remember, Dan, was the gun going off, me dropping it. We called 911, and the next thing I knew that I was butt naked back up from upside the pool. I don't remember being in the pool. I just remember being back in the room in front of some people in the room and being butt naked after I ran and threw off all my clothes.
The reports were that you were trying to clean off the blood, right?
Most likely, if I ran and jumped in a swimming pool in the middle of February, damn right, I was probably trying to get rid of something. Where if I was not with a crew that I should not have been with, not that they're good or bad people, they weren't people that I've been around a long time, somebody would have, you know, slapped me and said, Jason, you had an accident. Stop what you're doing. So I don't blame anybody. I pick my circles, and that's what I do now. I pick circles that help me get better every day.
And so in the middle of that, how drunk were you? Because it sounds to me from the way that you're explaining this that it's not that you had so much.
I drove home. It wasn't, you know, like I said before, Dan, one is too many to handle a gun. I wasn't stumbling with my words, but one, if you have one drink, if you don't have any drinks and you mishandle or recklessly handle a gun, it's a problem. So if I was a 001 or 025, I shouldn't have been.
What were you doing though? Were you just around with guns?
No, I was showing guns. I was in my bedroom where games are locked up. And we went in there.
To impress these people?
No, just, yeah, yeah. Yes, if I'm showing off guns, yeah, I would say, look, this shotgun is this one, and this one is this one. And everybody was holding one. And
Because you know, you're living the big life.
You're
now.
Living you're, the big
you're,
life.
You're trying
Instead
to show these guys.
Instead of showing somebody a Picasso, I'm showing somebody a gun. That's where my self-esteem was. What the hell am I doing that for? Why was I doing that? I don't know why. You know, But that's what I did. I've done it.
You don't
Before,
know why
I've done it a
now,
million times.
Examining your life even now from retrospect with all the introspection that you're doing, you still don't know why you
I
did
know
that?
I'm doing. I'm saying at the time I didn't know why. Right now I know I was doing because I had no self-esteem. I shouldn't have been doing that. I was going there to loan people money who had bad times, and that's why they were playing where they were playing. And then somewhere between there and there, I had 12 grown men or 14 grown men in a bedroom, in my bedroom where me and my wife lived, and I'm showing shotguns. What I shouldn't have been doing. That's, you know, that's what you live with. Can I replay it all back and think it was bad for me? Yeah, but it was bad for Mr. Christofi. And the hell with me, it was a bad situation.
But the adult you looks back at that you and says, you idiot, right?
Like 100%.
You haven't forgiven. It doesn't 100%. Feel like the way you're talking, it doesn't feel like this dude has forgiven himself or has forgiven that
well,
kid.
Well, I'm out of my circle right now. I'm out of my element. You know, when I'm back at the treatment center and I'm helping people get better, I'm in my element. You know, I get better there. It's been doing this for 4 years now, and I'm real good at it through the grace of God.
Well, because because you're so honest with
well,
it,
you know,
Jason.
I'm a warning or an example to some people, right? And the, most of the people you see here that came down with me, I'm both. So.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to upset you.
You don't have to be sorry, man.
Well, no, because I do. I appreciate the vulnerability of this story, but I don't love mining around in it for content because you are wounded right now.
Getting better every day, though, one day at a time.
But it seems like something that it's hard not like it's hard to ever forgive yourself for because you're sitting here blaming yourself for killing your father while we're at it.
Never been to a doctor in his life, no. And he couldn't get out of bed. And if my dad had a toe ache, I was the first one to be there to help him with it. And at this time, when all 20 lawyers are in your living room, the NBA, everybody else, there's helicopters and everything is going on outside and press everywhere, I selfishly didn't think that when he told me he couldn't get out of bed that he was talking about his own health. I didn't take time because my dad has never missed a day's work. So I should have been more keen to that. So, yes, two people died that day.
Will you forgive yourself? Like
every day I'm trying. That's what I do, what I do. You know, that's why I'm working. You know, I get a chance to sit in on class. I get a chance to, you know, lead a class. I get a chance to help these young people and old people, people middle age, get their life together. And they don't judge me. And that's what I'm very good at through the grace of God.
Tell the people, if you don't mind, and I do appreciate, like I've told you, it's odd that this came together this way because I really have been wanting to talk to you for a long time because I couldn't have imagined that there wouldn't be enormous life lessons in everything that happened to you. And I'm guessing that you've arrived in this place where that's, you're hoping that that's a small part of your story, that you can, because you feel like you've ended these lives, you're now trying to prevent, you're trying to save lives over here with what you're doing now and the reason you're so transparent with your story. So tell the people what this is specifically so that we can get you the appropriate promotion for what it is that you're working on as your life's work now as you try to repair your life.
It's Drug and Alcohol, Anxiety and Depression Center in Tequesta, Florida, right outside of Jupiter. Brand new state of art. We've been doing it for about 8 years there. I teach, it's called the Rebound at Futures Recovery Healthcare. You can go to Futures Recovery Healthcare or 855-502-HOPE. And what I do there is we teach people through outdoor adventure therapy, Dan. We jump out of airplanes. We scuba dive. We come to shows like this. Yesterday, we were doing the Segway. The other day, we went to Disney World. So we teach you through life application. We don't put you in a bubble for 30 days and then let you out and go, here goes the world. We take you around where there's drugs and alcohol, and we teach you how to have fun again. We build your self-esteem, overcome anxiety, you know, break down barriers. And then we still have our psychiatrists and psychologists is with us every single day. You get one-on-ones. It's a 12-step. It's the only place in the country that does it like this. You know, it's hard to get people to sit in the classroom for 8 and 10 hours and tell them you've been bad. Here we don't tell you what not to do. We show you different things to do. And I'm just happy to be a Futures Recovery Healthcare. It makes my heart happy.
And so you wander around and you relive all of these things again and again where you're sharing these parts of your life so that people understand. I mean, NBA All-Star, living the big life to father protecting him or trying to protect him from what he believes is a family. Like, you believe your family's a bit haunted, no? Your family is sort of – you have had too much grief for a lifetime, Jason.
I don't know if haunted is the right way. We've had challenges, and you know, and they all come from drugs and alcohol. You know, my sister was killed for $2 from a man who was trying to get heroin. She started using heroin when she got out the hospital. Probably the first woman in New York in 1982 to catch the AIDS virus, and it wasn't like you have it now. You know, she died at 41 pounds in 6 months. She was 6'1", beautiful lady. My second sister tried to help her because you understand when Sergio robbed her, he took a hammer and deformed her face. She was a model and he stabbed her 17 times. So we had to take the mirrors out of our house. So my other sister started using drugs with her and she got the AIDS virus, you know, and I had to raise their children. My third sister, husband came home, got drunk and was angry and he shot my sister in the face and killed her. Then he killed himself, you know, and here we go. You know, I have a brother who ran in, was driving and ran into the, you know, It's a lot to do with drugs and alcohol, and through the grace of God, I've been able to partner up with a place that really helps a lot of people.
You didn't finish what you were saying about your brother.
My brother hit the new Welcome to South Carolina sign, and he shortly right after that couldn't recover from that, and he died also. So there's a lot of drugs and alcohol that went on in our family. But I also have some sisters who are very, you know, and brothers who go on. I got a couple of brothers who are preachers, a principal of school. I have one who's one of the highest ranking people at CVS Target, you know, a vice president. So my dad, all his sons and daughters went to college, you know, so he's done a lot of good things. And I'm trying to be the one that you know, can recover from and help people, help me help others.
How much time have you spent in your life, if you're saying the idea of therapy isn't something that, or rehab, these aren't things that you thought of, how much time have you spent with introspection on how it is that all of that death that you're talking about has shaped you?
I usually right now, Dan, I try to surround myself with people who don't judge me. That's why we kind of handpick when you come into Rebound. We want to make sure that you want to get better and you want to make sure that you're going to be my family for the rest of your life. So, you know, if you call up, you know, 855, I don't sound like a commercial, 855-502-HOPE, you're going to speak to me.
No, that's why you're here, though. No, you're here. You do sound like a commercial, but the reason that you're here, you're telling this story this way, very vulnerably, breaking down, crying. The reason you're doing that is because there might be somebody in this audience right now that doesn't know they have a problem. And that number is not irrelevant to them. Right. We're not doing a telethon here. They know we're not doing a telethon here.
Right. And I just want, I want people to get better. And I and if you call up, you'll speak to me because you're going to be a part of my family for the rest of my life. And I don't want somebody to come in just to hang out with me. I want people to come in and change their life. And, you know, I hang out with all the Rebound alumni. We go to games. Next week I'm going up to the St. John's game. I got to get 31 tickets. You know, over 4 years we have 133 alumni. You know, so it's, they're all my family and we all root for each other. And if your name says Rebound behind it, if you went to Rebound and it said Dan and it said Rebound, I'm picking up. If it said, you know, Julio, Pastor, I'm not picking up. I pick up behind Rebound because we both certified each other. We stamped each other and we know we're calling each other just to tell each other we love you or if we need something, it's gonna, we really do need something.
So give out that telephone number again.
It's 855-502-HOPE, or you can get it at Futures Recovery Healthcare, and you can actually speak to me. You know, actually speak to me. It's a big place, but it's a small place.
So back to the question that I was asking you, how much introspection have you done about the ways that you were shaped by the amount of death that you've had in your life?
we've been working on a lot of EMDR on not looking back. And the best way I can help myself is by helping others, is by teaching. And every day I teach a course in the morning from 6:45 to 7:30. We might be on the ocean paddleboarding or something. I'm telling people my story, how I'm feeling today. Every time I'm teaching somebody something, it helps me learn more about the situation. I'm no expert on sobriety. I'm no expert in a mental illness, but we have experts there. But you know what? Most people haven't been through, like you said, as much as I've been through. And I'm still here trying to help others help me.
So forgive me. So in pressing on the question, what I'm doing, you're telling me flatly, hey, part of recovery is look ahead. Don't look in the thing that I'm asking you to look at. Which
exactly right. And you know what? I get up.
Okay,
every,
I'm sorry. Let me, I'm sorry.
Now, I get up every morning at 3:25. I don't have a clock in my house. Passion wakes me up. I get to the gym. I take care of myself for 2 hours. And then I'm on my way to work, and it takes me an hour to get there. I go through this video messaging app where I can talk to every one of our alumni. My word of the day might be Dan Lepetit, and boom, and we'll talk about it. We discuss. I see everybody's face on there, and we're all lifting each other up or somebody has a problem. And then I'm on my way to work. I stay there until about 8:30 at night. I get home about 9:15, 9:20. I'm back in bed. I do it again. It's a robotic life right now. It's the life I'm doing God's purpose right now. And maybe when I get better and better at this, maybe I can loosen up and not work 4 years and 15 days straight without a day off and never feel tired and maybe go on to a different part. Maybe one day be your co-host with you and
Bobby. But you used
Bobby.
To be. But Jason, you used to be. Like after your all-star career, you had how much of a media career and a lucrative media career?
Yeah. Yep. And I don't expect anybody after 19 years to say, hey, man, here, you know, you're Dan's co-host. I don't expect that. So I do what I do, and that's being at Rebound of Futures Recovery Healthcare.
But tell us about that time, because you're going to have to forgive my ignorance here, because I feel like I insulted you a little bit by saying you were a pretty good player. No, you were an all-star.
No.
And you were an all-star who also had charisma. You didn't get where you were because you had a good mouth. You had game, and you had a lot of charisma with that. And that turned into a media career that lasted how long?
Well, I think we were, for the rumors, we were a couple of weeks away from winning an Emmy on our first year with NBC. We were NBC before Charles Barkley.
You would have been great at this. You know that. Yeah. You would have been great at this.
Thank you.
But you know that. You don't need me to tell you. That was the path you were on.
It is my passion. It's my passion to one day be sitting with you on side of you or something in this. But to be honest, let's be transparent. You know, this is a different world. Even though it was 19 years ago, you know, I can get offers every single day to do shows. Of course, not as big as your show. But, you know, we just did the Today Show not long ago. You do 60 Minutes. You know, these are the type of shows I'm doing. I'm not in here telling you a story about Charles Barkley sitting on a bicycle. You know, I'm telling you stories about, you know, how I destroyed a life and how I destroy lives around people that love me. So what else can I do? I can't go back up to a mountain again. That didn't work. I try to isolate myself and get away from everybody. So I'm here, and this is what I do. Would I love to do what you do? Of course I would. But, you know,
I feel like some of the joy, though, what I remember from you as a broadcast personality, it was a joyous one. And it wasn't like when I thought of the party around Jason Williams, I didn't think of it having consequences. I thought the party around Jason Williams was going to be pretty fun because you were a guy who seemed to enjoy life. I didn't know you in any meaningful way, mm-hmm. but that guy doesn't stand in front of me now. That guy, like you seem like, I don't know how funny you would be on television right now, because it feels like you're a little bit understandably broken by everything this experience has been. I don't know how much funny you're doing these days.
Well, when I'm around my teammates, I'm back and I'm in there. I'm doing my thing. And my teammates are the people you see outside this window. You know, we have a good time. You know, this is an interview where we're talking about a man who I took everything from. So I find it very inappropriate in my life to be on here being the guy that I am. Joking and laughing or telling stories or being almost an Emmy Award winner or whatever you want to call it and being good in this business when I'm in this situation right now.
Jason, you served time, though. You served your punishment. It's not like you got off, like you didn't get off with
the
crime.
Biggest jail I haven't been to, and the one in my head. So I do have great days. It's days like this when I have to come in, and the first thing I worry about is I hope my daughters don't know I'm doing this, because they were like, Dad, why don't you just get back on? And they'll say, Dad, do what Dan does. You know, don't go back and talk about this. You don't have to talk about this no more. But, you know, my purpose right now, as I get better every day, is to lift the stigma. And if you had interviewed anybody who's on the other side of this window, they would tell you that, yeah, that Jason is still here when he's with us. It's when he comes in to do these type interviews.
Because we're rehashing all the shit, right. Jason. Yep. Like, and you're telling me, I don't, as part of my healing, I need to not be looking back anymore. And right. Here I am rehashing every last detail and of your worst pain.
And that's the price you have to pay to lift the stigma off of an addiction. I have to do this to save a life. You know, maybe somebody, you know, millions of people listen to your
but
show.
It hurts,
maybe one
Jason.
More
I'm uncomfortable. Like, I'm uncomfortable poking and prodding you. It feels uncomfortable to me because I'm seeing you here dissolve. You're a strong man, obviously. And I'm feeling great guilt about again and again pressing on this button. And but yet it's fascinating. And I think this is the only way to lift the stigma is by humanizing.
Yeah.
By humanizing your, if you're the stigma, this humanizes it. You can't get a job, you're telling me. You can't get a broadcasting job, or who would hire you? You served time. That time had to be pretty awful, no? The time was.
Time was awful. You know, time was awful. And even when you get out, the biggest jail is the one in your head. You know, by thinking about, you know, trying not to think about the past. Yeah, time is, you know, I've done Miss State, Northern State. I've done. Some of the Rikers Island. I've done Rikers Island, you know, for a year. These are tough places to be. I don't care who you are and how much you've been from New York and how much they love you there. You're still in there with 15,000 people. And some people in there are very good people. And guess what? You know what's crazy? 85% of the people in there is because of drugs and alcohol. You know, we all, anybody listening to this, have escaped jail one way or the other by the hair that's, you know, on their chin. So it's a tough situation. It's tough. I survived it.
In terms of comfort level, how comfortable you were talking about Rikers Island and the prison experience? Because
I talk about it every single day because you know what it does? And I don't do it just for the shock value because, look, you know, Michael Strahan goes and he'll talk to people, rah-rah them up, the salespeople. But when people ask me to come in, I'm speaking to the CEOs and telling them not to drive drunk. You know, don't embezzle. You know, don't put your hand on a woman, sexual harassment, because you guys can't handle jail. That's how. So Strahan might be going, ha, ha, rah, 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 let's go out and sell. I'm telling you, you can't handle it. And if you can't handle jail, Dan, if you are tough enough to handle it, can your parents handle it? Can your wife handle it? Can your kids handle it? The ripple effect that goes down, you know, the self-esteem value. I seen kids in jail who are 18 years old, got into a fight. Maybe jumped out their car. Well, yeah, they did jump out their car, got into something, hit another kid who's a couple years older and got 21 years. And this is just not one. You got people in here serving a lot of time for drugs. That's why you have the only disease that tells you have a disease, right? That tells you don't have a disease. The only disease you can go to jail for. 85% of the people in prison are there for drugs and alcohol. You know, I grew up with Jay-Z. I like Jay-Z. He's been to my house. He's been all this. But, you know, even that, like, how can you do something on reentry and not speak to me so I can help you help others, right? These are the kind of things that I love doing. You know, I love.
Jay-Z's old enough to remember to watch your entire arc, to learn the lessons from your entire arc. Because Jay-Z at the time, I mean, you were peers? I don't know.
He's been to my house. We're friends. And, you know, anybody that's doing anything, Meek, anybody, like, let's sit down. And I truly believe this, Dan. You know, there's no white coat or stethoscope that can make people better in treatment, right? You come in, you detox them. We got the best detox in the country. You come in, you get them off drugs. You analyze them from there while they're sober, and you build their self-esteem. Right? You get the way of the anxiety. You break down those barriers, and then you go from there. You don't put drugs on top of drugs on top of drugs. You can really change the world by changing one person at a time. You know, they say 1,000 spiders can tie down a lion. I believe that. I would love to have come in here and you ask me stories and we're going in a different direction. But that's not what I'm doing right now. Right now I'm trying to.
Well, we can do that another time, though. Because you have amazing stories. Your stories are crazy. No, your stories are crazy. You could sit here during that time in the NBA, the stories that you can tell. I'm sorry. I don't want to keep yanking you around emotionally. Because this clearly hurts you, but you have all those stories, Jason. If we were to go in the file, the Barkley stories that you would tell, I don't know where you want to start or how I can get the best stuff out of you, but I am sure that you have some good stories you can tell.
I'll tell you what, the next time I come down here, you invite me back. I would love to sit down with you in a different atmosphere and we go from there.
Okay.
You know, today we're here to save some lives.
All right. Well, maybe we'll do part two then, because I want to do some of the lighter stuff with you. We got the mentions that you want. I'm sure the people are moved by this. I felt that there are a couple of instances where you're just not quite ready to look in some of the places. I was asking you about prison because I wanted some of the details of what that experience was, and you, took that toward talking about Rebound and the work that you're doing. I don't want to keep pushing you toward places that you don't want to look. If part of your recovery I'm not supposed to be looking there.
No, part of my recovery is being very transparent. How much more of jail do you need to know?
Well, just how awful it was. What your first day was like, what the worst days were like.
First day I was in jail, we were at a place in Trenton, and it's called the Assessment Center. And you got to go in, and it's January or February. I walk in, you're butt naked, and you got about 50 people that are butt naked. I'm 80 pounds overweight. It's about 8 degrees outside, and I'm a grower, not a shower. My peanut is this big, and I go to walk through a place where you're going to be spending a lot of time, and I go into a place, and I'm sitting in a place with on my knees. I'm kneeling down with five other guys kneeling behind us in a single line. One guy in front of me, a Puerto Rican guy, has on his pants, and there's somebody in the back row named Rashid is calling me. Yo, Jay, man, can you I need you to do me a favor, and I got to pass something down. I'm like, pass something down? I said, man, you know, I'm not doing anything. My first day, they leave me the hell alone. And the Spanish guy in front of me goes, Jay. He goes, Hombre, you got to pass this down. I ain't passing nothing. And his receiver says, Jay, pass it down, man. I said, all right, man, come on, pass it to me. And this is my first day. I'm not in jail 3 hours at Assessment Center. And the guy reaches down, Dan, into his pants, into his rectum, and is digging around down there and goes to pull something out. And I go, oh, hell no. And I lean back, and he throws something back to Rashid, right, who takes that from he just threw and put it up his rectum. And as he's doing that, it hit the floor. I looked, and it's a telephone, and not one of these new ones, one of these big old phones. And I was like, oh, my God, what am I into now? And this is a true story.
You're coming from millions of dollars in a mansion.
And I just seen a one man take a phone out of his behind and give it to another man who put it up his behind. And then there was a guy in front of me, hombre, one more, uno más, and throw it. I said, man, if you got to go up your pants again, I'm not passing nothing back. He's like, yeah, and he went up there, and Rashid was like, Jay, pass, I'll lean back. He threw it this time, and it sounded heavier, and I said, oh, my God, the guy got, what else he got? I looked down, it was the charger. It was a big block charger. So, you know, the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted a retrial, right? These guys are way too tough for me.
Holy shit.
Yeah, man. And now, that's a true story.
No, I know, but I think that you have stories like that for days about a million different things.
For days.
And I want more of them.
All right. But have me back.
But I want more of them right now. I want to hear what the last day was
I'll tell you, almost to the last day was this big guy in there. His name is Bojack. And what he used to do is he used to go around and he was the barber. And you come in and if you're a newbie, a new guy in, you know, he'll go by, he had a little lift like Mike Tyson. He talked like this. And he'll go look in your cell, and you be naked or changing. And he'll look by, And when he hears something, he sees something he like, he go, that pot. And when you hear that pot, right? And I'll be like, hey, man, don't go in there, little kid. Don't do it, mister. Don't go in there. And they go, man, who is that? I go, it's Jason Williams. Jason Williams ain't in jail. He got too much money. He ain't go to jail. And I'm like, no, it's Jason. And they'll go in there, and then the barber, Bojack, He'll take them and knock them out. And then he'll do what they want to do with them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's
through a lisp of
a lisp.
And
let me tell you something. I had another guy in there whose name was Johnson. He was about 6'10", all muscles, done about 25 years. And one day when I was feeling like I was about to get out on my last day, I started talking like paying the dozens, and he couldn't keep up with me. And he said, "Hey, man, come here. Let me talk to you in this bathroom." Right? And he walked in, and he's all swollen. And you know who's in jail, because if it's a white person, they can play spades. You know, if you see him, a white person, and they can play spades, he's been in prison. And a black guy, you're going to see him. He's going to be real thick up top with no legs. Right? Because they do chin-ups all day. All right, so we went in there, and he was like, you know, and he told me the coldest thing somebody's ever told me. He said, "Jason," he said, "look here, brother. You see all these muscles? See this bowed head? You see this?" And he's flexing. He says, "See, that's all for show. See, I can't fight, but don't let me have to jump off on your big ass and find out you can't fight either." That was the coldest shit. I almost had to go back in and apologize to everybody, but that was the coldest something somebody ever told me, Dan.
Your last day in prison, what was that like?
Last day in prison, I was leaving out of Rikers Island. And when I was leaving out of Rikers Island, I was supposed to get out of 1201 because I was on some kind of medication. They wouldn't let me leave until 6. So about 4 or 5 of my friends and Charles Oakley are waiting outside of Rikers from 12 until 6. So the warden was good enough to send a bus this way, so all the press went that way, and we took another bus out this way. And I went in there, and they was all sleeping in the car, so they let me out the bus. I ran in with my bag, and I'm like knocking on the door, and the press looks back, and they start running to me, and everybody's sleeping in the damn car. And it was one of the Oaks used car. He didn't know how to open the damn lock. So I was like, "Come on, come on, come on, come on." I jump in the car. We go to Bomonti's in Brooklyn, right, where all the people go, all the gangsters, and, you know, great food and everything else, and they open
they're,
up.
They're
and,
showing you a big time yeah, after it, after it, how right. much time in prison?
27 months.
So after 27 yeah. months, Oakley, they're yeah. going to show you the first night out of prison. Night.
Right. So we go into there, Dan, and it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I have not had tomatoes or cheese because you got either in prison. And I ate so many tomatoes and so much cheese that I spent my first day out of jail in the emergency room constipated.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you just were
I just couldn't.
Eating,
I could.
You were eating?
I was eating so much cheese that I got blocked up.
And you had to.
And so Oakley said, "Look, even... I'll pick you up out of jail, but damn, I'm going to bring you in there because you can't shit." You know? So he left me right? in the emergency room.
He's a good friend.
He's
huh?
a great friend. He's one of the most misunderstood human beings in the world.
Well, but those stories that you would have to tell. Now, I've never gotten close to the Jordan stories, and Oakley's got all of those.
Right.
Like, Oakley's got all of them. Does he share any of those with you, or do you get into a bad spot if you start revealing Oakley's stories
well,
of Jordan?
Well, I think that you know, one of the stories with him, Dan, is that why everybody loves him because he don't tell stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he just
of course he doesn't. Of course he doesn't.
I tell you one thing. We were playing one time and down in Hilton Head, South Carolina, was playing golf with Julius Erving. And Julius Erving is not a very good golfer. And I'm probably going to get in trouble for telling this story. But he kept hitting the ball, and you got the big long fingers out of bounds. He goes, "I think I'll find it." Now, we're in Hilton Head in August, snakes everywhere. And he'll go in the woods and automatically find his ball and hit it out. And Oakley will be like, "You think Julius found that ball? That's bull, man. He ain't find that damn ball." And then we'll come in, we're going to whip it out. So when you lose, you pay $2,500 a hole right there. And we were losing and losing. He lost 4 holes. And at the end, he took the money and just threw $10,000 at Julius Erving. "I'm out of here." And he had a motorcycle, and he rode it back to my house, and he started cooking for everybody, and we was going to go play basketball on Hilton Head Island. So Julius Erving was going to play basketball. So the YMCA let everybody know, "I'm coming down with Julius Erving, Michael Strahan, Wayne Corbett, all these people." And then we go to play in there, and it's about 3,000 people at the Y now. And I go, "Julius, you and Oak will be on our team. We all be on the team. We'll play against the Natives." And Oak goes, "I want to play on this team." I was like, "Uh-oh." I was like, "What that mean, man? That son of a bitch was cheating me." I was like, "Oh, it's Doc. It's the Doc, man. We grew up on it." He said, "That's your damn friend. It ain't my friend. He cheated." So I'm like, "Uh-oh." So I go, "Hey, Julius, let's sit this one out. I go, no. Julius goes, hey, young buck, don't worry about me. He wants some of the doctor. He'll get some of the doctor.
No, no, Julius, no. How old is Dr. J at this point?
That's about 15, 16. He was in good shape, man.
All right.
So Dr. J is saying,
I'm not afraid of Oakley. And Oakley's saying, he cheated at golf. I'm going to get this motherfucker.
Right. So he puts the ball out like this for a check, right? And Doc is on defense, right? So they check it up. And then Oakley puts it back out again. So you know once you check the ball, it's live. So Oakley's holding the ball in front of Junior's face. And I'm like, what is he doing? So Doc just takes some long fingers and tips it out his hand, and it goes toward the other basket. So Junior gets the ball, starts running down. Everybody stands up, kind of afros throwing back like everybody's waiting for him to go up and do his master dunk. Then ready to get up. And so I saw Junior. Here comes Charles Oakley running like, Rrr. I'm like, what the hell is Oakley running behind Julius for?
Oh, no.
And he runs all the way around, and Julius goes to lay it up, and Doc goes, pow, Oakley punches him right in the mouth. and Doc didn't have them little soup coolers. He had them big soup coolers, right? So we had to take a whole roll of toilet paper and put it in his mouth. But he did finish the game, but did not drive inside. And you know Julius couldn't shoot. But he was taking 3 points.
Wait a minute. You're telling me.
I'm telling you that.
You're telling me because he cheated at golf, Dr. J, one of the classiest guys in the history of the league, you're telling me that Oakley purposely allowed Dr. J a fast break just so he could punch him in the mouth.
I'm telling you right now, Julius must have got 100 stitches. We was there all night with those lips putting in that stuff together. I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to put words or I was there. I'm not saying it was on purpose. I know that Julius Erving played with a mouthful of a whole roll full of Charmin for the rest of the game and had to get stitched up.
I appreciate you ending on that note. That's a good way to get an invite back so you can tell some more of these stories.
You're the man, Dan.
One more time.
Hello, bro.
I will do that on the way out. Tell the people one more time what it is that you're doing or how they can get in contact with you if they were reached by this and they need help.
You can call me at 855-502-HOPE. Or you can get online and go at Futures Recovery Healthcare. You can ask to speak to me. I help you for any drugs and alcohol. We're the best facility. We got the best medical team, the best psychiatrist, 10-acre campus.
Where can they read about it? Where they can read about it there?
Futures Recovery Healthcare. Just go right online, and you can look at it right there. And I appreciate you, Dan. And give your dad a hug for me, and I love you, brother.
Well, we'll have you back because
thank you,
I'm
man.
Telling you, I know how many stories you have. I know that they're all good. So I look forward to hearing more of them.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Our thanks to Jason Williams for sharing that time with us. We will have him back because he does have a ton of stories. You can see somewhere within the shell of what's happened to him, you can see that those stories and that charisma and that personality is still there. But you got to do some digging to get to it because that's a man in pain. From the serious subject matter, we go to the lighter stuff. If you want to support more of the things with Lebatard and Friends, Mystery Crate, get in here and promote what you got going on.
Hey, we're the shipping container.
This is an odd one to have a bunch of jovial voices on. Should we sit this one out? Because, I mean, I laughed. I cried a lot during that. We're just like a silly podcast that does a lot of random things. You never know what you're going to get. And just so you know, you're never going to get what you got on this.
If you don't want the heavy-handed, the ponderous, the polysyllabic, if what you want is just a flume of amusement that will tickle your heart, the Mystery Crate podcast is some place where you can find some fun.
And sometimes it's our voices or sometimes it's voices associated with the show. In terms of what you'll get this week on Mystery Crate, Greg, tell them.
You never know.
Yeah, never know.
He's the worst.